If you're looking to create a life worth living in your faith, family, and career, you're in the right place. Welcome to Beyond the Rut, the podcast that shares encouraging stories and practical advice to help pull you out of your rut into that life worth living. I'm your host, Jerry Dugan, and in this episode, we're going to be joined by a friend of mine and mentor. He calls himself the anti-guru, John McLernan. Now, John hails from the country of Canada, eh? And I don't think he says A during the interview. But anyway, what we're going to be talking about is how do you define your life, your success, in the lens of your faith, your family, your fitness levels, your finances, and future possibility, the things I call the five F's in living that life worth living. Because a lot of us just aim for nothing and hit it with amazing accuracy. And it turns out, once in a while, I find a podcaster who has the same heart, the same message, just says it with a slightly different accent and a different perspective. And that's the coolest thing, because chances are you've listened to my show a number of times and some things hit really well, some things don't. And sometimes I bring on a guest who says almost the same thing, but with a different voice. And you're like, you know what? I get what John is saying. I get what that other guy is saying. And that's okay with me, because the important thing isn't that you look at me and it's not about me. This is about you. This is about you creating a life worth living in your faith, family, and career. So we're going to be talking about how do you find that authenticity in your life? How do you create that alignment with your faith journey as a Christian, if you're a Christian, or your core values, if you're not? How do you make sure that you are supporting your family, living out your dream, and basically having your cake and eat it too? So sit back, relax, grab a notebook and a pen, because here we go. All right. Hey, Coach John, thanks for joining me. How are things going for you?
It's absolutely fantastic. I love the show. I love the idea, because I've been in a lot of ruts. I feel like I'm really well qualified to be here. I'm like, one rut? If you've only been in one rut, you haven't lived.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's more than one. And we used to say on the show all the time that eventually you get yourself into a groove and you're like, things are easy. Things are running smoothly. But our warning to folks is that if you aren't aware of where you're going, that groove could become your next rut. And oftentimes, and talking to guests for the last 8 years, that's exactly what we found out. And same for your show, between the before and after.
Yeah.
It's those stories during that time that really shape us into who we are. We almost always think like, hey, the guy at McDonald's just instantly, boom, had a product. And it's like, there was a lot of story in between. And
I just heard you say something, 8 years of producing the show. I'm like, man, I've been producing mine for two, and it feels like I've got a pretty established show in the podcasting world. 8 years.
Yes.
I got some catching up to do.
I don't know, because I think I repeated the first year 7 times, so this sometimes feels like it's my true second year. Like, as far as like when I look back and look at the growth and the process and that kind of thing, it's like, it's really been in the last year or two that things have climbed up. And when I listen to the first 5 years, I'm like, ooh. It's almost like listening to the first few episodes of my show over and over. And it's like, okay, let's go past that. I took a look at your website as well, johnmclernan.com, and you do mentorship, and you're helping people really live their best life. And that speaks to me, because this show is all about creating a life worth living in your faith, family, and career. What specifically do you focus on when it comes to mentoring others? I'm just curious about that.
I think not trying to pretend that I have all the answers, do everything I do, because the business that I have is not necessarily the business that you want. And maybe like there really isn't a template for this. And that's one of the great things to think about here is I don't have to have all the answers when I'm mentoring you. My goal is to help you see that you have the answers in you, but I'm going to help you unlock those answers. There's some solid business principles that we want to employ or apply, but it's how do we shape those business principles to work for you, to help you build the life that you want. And the life that you want to build may not look exactly like the life that I have or the business that I have, but there's these wonderful principles that kind of carry over.
A good mentoring relationship, or even a good coaching relationship, it's not just the person being coached who grows, or the mentor who's growing. Person mentoring is also growing. They're learning from the person they're helping, but then as they're growing, they're like, hey, I just did this thing. It sounds like it's applicable to what you're going through, and would you like to learn it? And they're going to be like, heck yes. I just got bonus content for free. You kidding me? I love that. It's
right. Right.
I've been in a couple of programs to help me, launch the business I've got going, that I really started almost a year ago. Yeah. But it was this help from other people sharing this bonus stuff with me. I'm like, oh, those are the nuances I wouldn't pick up from a book or a video or just an online course. And I love having that other person who can bounce ideas off, ask the tough questions like, hey, what do you want to do this week? Like, it's like, what, you're asking me?
That's part of the value of I'm a one-on-one mentor, not a group mentor. And I think this is an important distinction. I recognize that as a one-on-one mentor, like, it's not as scalable as if I was just running a group coaching program. But there's something about getting into the room with one other person and going, let's hammer this out. Let's have a back and forth. Let's take the time to discuss this and hash out ideas where you get your ideas get one-on-one attention with me. That makes a huge difference. You know, one of the things that sort of troubles me about the mentorship or the guru sphere, as I like to call it, is just this idea that everything has to be scalable. Everything has to go at six figures or seven figures or eight figures and so on. And look, having a profitable business matters. Of course, you want your business to earn you an income and so you can stay in business. But when you make that your central focus and, you know, like, really nobody's impressed by it except maybe like somebody else in some sort of mentorship. Well, this term I'd use that I won't use for this show, but how about, say, in mentorship circles, people might be impressed by you bragging about your numbers, but the average person doesn't care. What they care about is can you help me and do you feel fulfilled in the business that you're doing? Because if you don't, the numbers or the money isn't going to make you happy.
Oh, yeah. And that even works in a corporate space too, that people aren't quitting because they're not making as much. They're quitting because they're not growing where they are. They don't feel connected.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with any kind of coaching relationship or mentoring relationship. If the person running the show is just in it for the money, one, people see right through that, and you're probably not getting the signups that you want. You're not helping the people you want to help in the first place. And if you are, probably a lot of refunds happening too, or a lot of churn. You're not really deepening the connection for the long term. And I've seen programs where they have that deep connection, and it's almost like this, well, like they say, community. It's like it's ongoing. They just keep signing up, even though they've already achieved the initial thing they wanted. But that's their trusted advisor. And I love on your website, you refer to yourself as the anti-guru. And yeah. I love that. And you just shared why.
I'm a simple guy. I live a relatively simple life. And so I value being fulfilled and having time freedom over like hustling and grinding and trying to chew through as many people as possible to generate numbers in a spreadsheet. Like, it just doesn't work for me. Now, if that's the kind of business that you want, hey, power to you. It's just not the one that I want. I like the freedom to work with who I choose, who I feel like is a good fit. And so I keep my mentorship fairly small scale for that reason. It's kind of like boutique.
Yeah. And in your website, you also say why, because you'd rather spend that extra time, as much time as you can, dating your wife, spending time with your wife. And at the end of the day, I mean, I'm sure you're not going to be on your deathbed thinking, man, I wish I scaled my mentoring program. I don't think that's going
to
be the thing.
Wish I'd scaled it to nine figures.
Right.
And again, nothing against that. But like, frankly, I don't require that to live the life that I want to live. And it's a beautiful thing to not need that. And there'll be people who disagree with me. And please, you're very welcome to disagree with me and my approach. And that's why there's different types of mentors out there and different goals. The ultimate thing, though, is like happiness and fulfillment. So every morning, I read a couple stories with my little fella. We have like snuggle time. He's two, so he's kind of getting bigger than just like snuggle time. But like, you know, we make breakfast, have breakfast together, tell some stories, have some jokes, maybe drive some cars around. Like, I don't get that back. And then my second son, so I'm recording this, is 2 months old. And I'm looking at him thinking, like, this might be the last time I get to hold a little baby like this that's my own. And so I am so wanting to cherish that time. And so I love what I do professionally, but it's definitely secondary to moments like that.
Yeah. And I'm that old guy now that gets to say, yeah, do cherish that, because it goes by in a blink of an eye. I used to roll my eyes at those guys and like, dang it, now I'm that guy that I used to make fun of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think like some nights I'm just tired, right? Maybe my kid woke up, or well, one or the other, or both of them woke up at different times of the night. I'm just like, I'm tired. And I'm like, why can't you kids just sleep through the night? But I remember one time just like holding my son in the middle of the night. I was like, man, I'm kind of frustrated that I'm awake, and he's crying. I'm like, so you're frustrated that you're awake as well. But here we are together in the dark in this moment, and I'm trying to let my wife get a bit of sleep here. And I'm just like, okay, little dude, it's me and you. Okay. And if nothing else, I hope you can feel this love going from my heart to yours, and that even if you're not happy right now, that you'll go back to sleep because you feel safe and secure in my arms.
Oh,
and
man.
just turned into this like beautiful moment where I was like, you know, I was just tired, frustrated, and cranky and so on, to like this beautiful moment of like holding my son in love at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, those are the things that you look back and you go like, that was precious.
To recognize that's your moment that you've got, take it and enjoy it, cherish it, kind of thing. There's a lot of folks out there who bypass it. Like, oh, just get to sleep, kid. And, you know, I got to go back to bed myself. And that to me is a big, one, a challenge in life. And two, it goes back to, you know, the whole essence of Beyond the Rut is that we want to help people create a life worth living in their faith, family, and career so that they're living beyond that rut. And, you know, a big part of that is you got to know what you want. What is your definition of success? You know, like earlier, you know, I didn't want to be a doctor. That wasn't my dream. That was my mom's dream. And, you know, right, and you know, right. For you, like if we look at the family pillar of life or the five F's, you know, as far as your values, family is very important, more than finances. Like, you know, finances support the family, but I'm not going to give up this moment just so I could go make a buck. And
there'll be time, I'm sure, like later in my life where maybe the kids are growing, they're going to school, they're more independent, they're doing the thing, that maybe I'll apply myself more. It's not, look, I make a good living. I'm not going to pretend, you know, I'm not going to walk around saying like I drive a Lamborghini or something like that either. I'm not going to pretend something I'm not, but I do make a good living. And I make it in a way that works for me, that allows me to have the time to get with my family that I want. And, you know, my wife and I, we, you know, it's like we talk about, like we wish in some ways we could hold on to these moments, but we know that we can't. And that's actually what makes them more precious and more, because I can't hang on to that. But what we want to be able to say is when these days are gone with my kids being little, that like we cherished them. We won't look back with regret thinking, I wish I'd done more. I wish I could, you know. No, we cherished them. We loved them. We appreciated them. And we did the best we could in those moments.
Something that's standing out to me right now, or I'm thinking about as we're talking, because you and I are kind of on the same page as far as we would give up a six-figure income at a corporate job or a job title if it meant, you know, spending more time with family, or if the job or that paycheck was going to compromise my time with family. And that's a decision you and I have probably made. And then I know folks, like, because their voices are in my head here, folks that believe, no, you got to put in the work while you're young and build up all this investment capital and invest now. And so you got to work hard now so you can, you know, live like no one else. So you can live like no one else later on is a phrase that's popular out there in church circles.
I can respect that view, but my life's been unconventional in so many senses of the word. I went from like nanotech researcher to marine engineer in the Navy to globetrotting nomad to, you know, heavy equipment operator in the oil patch to supplement store owner to online business owner to mentor and podcaster, you know, and having kids at 39 and 41. Like, but my wife and I also went, you know, it's like, why put all those things into my advanced years? Why? You know, I'm so glad that between the ages of like 27 and 31, my wife and I were traveling the world, because a lot of people wait until that's something I'm going to do in retirement. Of course, when we were doing this, we didn't predict that like COVID was going to be a thing and shutdowns and travel was going to be forever changed. We look back now, we're like, wow, we are so glad that we did that instead of like buying a mortgage. Now, there'll be people who bought a mortgage or a house in their 20s, they have a mortgage and their mortgage is probably 2/3 the way paid off. And in one sense, yes, they're building a different type of wealth, but we have a type of experiential wealth that you just can't get back. And there's something about, you know, we've lived in 7 countries around the world. You just, those moments like don't come back. And that's worth more than all the money in the world to have had those experiences.
Where I used to live, I was the kid in the group. All my friends were easily 10, 15 years older than me. And seeing them retire and having to stay close to, because they have the same thing. I'm going to, you know, retire and travel the world. I'm going to retire and do this. I'm going to finally pursue my dream when I'm done working for the man. And they get there and it turns out their health, there we go, that's the word I'm trying to say, their health is failing them. And so all that money they saved up now has to go to medical costs. They can't go on the big trips they wanted because they have to be close to the doctor. They have to go in for medical exams on a routine. And it's not just like one or two people. It's a lot of my friends who hit that age. And I thought, oh no, I don't want that. And even when I had a mortgage, like we don't anymore, not because we paid off the house, but we sold the house just a couple years ago when the market was booming in the US. We paid off everything, all the debt gone. And it was like, wow, we just gave ourselves a $1,500 a month pay raise by paying off the consumer debt, the mortgage, all the cars, everything gone. We got freedom. Like all of a sudden our savings just got multiplied in terms of like, we went from like 2 months worth of savings to I think 6 or 7 months, all just by paying off our consumer debt when we sold the house. It was a different type of freedom. And I mean, now I'm like a year into leaving my corporate job and it's like, yeah, I like that. But you know, I felt trapped having a mortgage and you know, somebody else's version of success. You got to have a house. You got to own a house. It's like, Yeah.
Just thinking about it differently. I feel like sometimes like the game is rigged for a lot of people and this, the pursuit of wealth. And again, this is not me discouraging it. Look, I run a business. I do have elements of scale built into my business. I do have ways of generating passive income and things like that because these things matter. But I think what we're trying to express from our perspective here is like, don't let that be the thing that matters the most.
Yeah. 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 I really understand what, I don't know about you, but for me, yeah, maybe it's a little bit of a morbid perspective of the world from being in the army. But I really, really thought about it at a young age. What, when I die, when I'm on my deathbed, let's say I'm lucky enough to lay in a bed and die of old age, what will my life have looked like over those years? What kind of relationships will I have had? What kind of relationships will I still have? And I've even shared this with folks where like an uncle of mine had passed away who had married into the family. Turns out he kind of died a hermit and there was a whole other family that he had before he married into ours that I didn't know about. Three kids, all of them had zero relationship with him. And he always had this bitterness about him. And I could tell in his final years, there was some regret, but he never quite voiced what it was. But he kind of looked at me like his favorite nephew in a sense. And then I understood why, like he has three kids out there. He had zero relationship with, and he regretted that at the end. Those three kids are bitter at him. Like he wasn't there. And I thought, wow, one guy impacted four lives, his own and three other people, plus future generations, better or worse. And I thought, oh man, so what kind of relationships matter to me? And you know, I think the theme we keep coming back to between the two of us here is you got to know what success looks like for you. And you got to know what value you want, what you hold on to is important and live that. And
you know, the one thing my kids will never wonder is if I loved them. Mm. So sometimes I'll be on a call with a client and maybe my little kid, my toddler manages to scoot away from mom and like burst into the office and climb into my lap. And you know, most of my clients are actually really cool about it. Like he's adorable. So that's permissible. And so, well, in my head, I'm like, yeah, I kind of need him to leave because obviously I'm working right now. I try very hard not to express that to him. I just give him a kiss. Oh, I love you. Thank you for coming to say hi. You know, give dad a big cuddle. And then usually by that time, mom will have got here to sort of escort him back out. And so I don't ever want him to feel like he is like an impediment to my life, but he's a crucial part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think by doing that, you're showing them that, yes, there are some boundaries, like when dad's at this station doing this thing, unless it's an emergency, probably don't run up to him. However, if I really need dad, I can go up to him. And there's,
yeah,
that door is open. And that's a very important door to keep open, especially when they become middle schoolers. I don't wish this on you. But for us, the toughest years of parenting were when our kids were middle schoolers. And it was just like, we went from engaged, they always wanted to hear from us to they clammed up. All of a sudden they weren't talking as much. And we had to find a new way to get past those new barriers. And high school got a lot better. Once they became sophomores in high school, it was like, we got our kids back. But yeah. That window from sixth grade, actually more like seventh grade to ninth grade, it was like, what happened? Yeah. It was like, oh, they became us when we were teenagers.
Yeah, from like 11 to 14 when they're just trying to find themselves.
Yeah.
You know, what? Actually, here's something I'm kind of quietly and slowly working towards becoming a clinical psychologist.
Really?
Other things.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why not?
Because why not? Right. So my goal is that like by 50, I'll be like a registered clinical psychologist. And I'm involved in, among other things, also involved in neuroscience research. And a lot of my work on the coaching side of things revolves around behavioral psychology and neuroscience. Mm. I often joke that nutrition is the cover story. And I have such a fascination for that. And so I also try to apply this to my relationships, understanding how brains work and how the different stages of development work and how like we connect in different ways as our kids kind of go through life. And so I don't try to psychoanalyze my kid, but I have this lens where I just say that all behavior makes sense. And so I'm just going to try to understand his behavior in the moment. And other people would look on and think, well, actually, I don't even know what they think, except for maybe like, I wouldn't parent like that because my kid's having a meltdown and I get down into his level and I go, hey buddy, you got big feelings right now? Yeah. Awesome. Mad or sad? What are you feeling right now? Oh, mad. Okay. Let's figure out how big is your mad? Is it like this big or is it like this big? And you know, before you know it, he's like, huh, how big is my mad? He's forgotten whatever it was he was mad about because he's sitting there trying to think of like, how big is it right now? You know? And if we get past that one, it'd be like, hey, what color is it, do you think? And so, instead of me, you know, going in there and being like, shut up, kid, you know, you know, trying to impose my will on him. Instead, I get down to his level and I engage with him. I'm like, and I get curious about it because like kids got no filters. And so, anyways, I just share that as an example of a fascination with how brains work and how psychology works. And for those of you who are parents out there and busy parents and like trying to run a business and trying to balance family life and stuff, you know, get curious about your kids' behavior sometimes. I think that's a fun way to make some of the tough times a lot more manageable.
I was just thinking about the possibilities you'll have on impacting other people because, you know, coaching is great. You help people be future focused. You know, what is it I want to do in the next 6 months, year, years from now? And that's where coaching is really great. It helps you stay on track to where you want to be. But one thing that coaches really shouldn't do is delve into helping people heal in their past. Cause now you cross into psychology or psychiatry and therapy and being a clinical psychologist does open that door.
I joke that I'm not a psychological archaeologist. Like we'll use past behavior to understand present behavior. I have this idea that all behavior makes sense. And so again, it's not me going back. I don't say we're going to go back, then I'm going to try to fix that. But if we can understand where a behavior comes from, we can now show ourselves grace and compassion. So another part of my story is, you know, for a number of years, I struggled with very intense self-loathing because I'd become obese, because I'd went through trauma and I fell into binge eating and food addiction. And I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know what was happening to me. I didn't know how I could be so educated in what I was doing and still like be this, well, binge eating food addict. I didn't know what was going on. So that was what started to spark my interest in and around this, is trying to understand like, why is it that I know eating an entire like chocolate cake while watching Netflix at 3 o'clock in the morning is not a healthy thing to do, but I feel compelled to do it.
Yes.
And so I don't do that anymore. But if you ever find yourself in that situation, just know that I've been in that situation before and it's okay. We'll figure something out.
Yeah. And it's like those little steps, right? Like, you know, try to cut it off by 2 a.m. or no kidding.
Yeah, that's right. Progress, not perfection, is so important.
Now, one of the things that you had mentioned to me way back was you know, how your own faith has evolved over the years as you've added life experiences to it. And I know some folks that they don't take the time to reflect on this, and they're just kind of either the same old person or they latch down onto their faith almost fanatically in the sense of like a narrow mindedness. So like, how has your faith evolved over the years?
Oh man. So it's actually, the timing of this couldn't be like more prescient as well, because it so happens that the Christian fellowship that I'm a part of is really, and we're not the only ones going through it, going through a crisis related to like sexual abuse and child sexual abuse. And I'm on the forefront of fighting against it. I'm actually literally producing a second podcast that's exploded in popularity called The Hidden Truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Breaking the Silence. And I interview survivors and ex-members and things like that. Now, we're not LDS or Mormon, which some people might want. Nothing against anybody if you are, by the way. but anyways, so how has my faith evolved? Well, I at first was like a strict sort of adherent rule follower, follow the book. Anybody who doesn't, kind of almost like, well, you're a sinner, heathen, that's going to like burn in hell, and kind of a misunderstanding of like who God is. Then I went through my own traumatic experience where I nearly died. And all of a sudden, I rethink things. And I realized that I was what I call a cerebral Christian. So I can quote scripture. I'm a great brain. I can't take the credit. Got it free of charge. But, you know, I could speak about things and sound very eloquent and say the right things. And people are saying, amen, yeah, you know. And then God was like, wham, here's an experience that's going to knock you flat and make you realize that if you keep the path going on the path you're on, you might actually be bound for hell. And I was, it seems like a crazy thing to say because I thought I was being a really good Christian. And but thankfully, God in his mercy took me through an experience like that, where in that experience, I was like, I can't die tonight. I can't, I got to fix some stuff. You know, I got to do things differently. And God was showing me that I was a cerebral Christian. And he's like, no, this is about your individual relationship with me. It's not about your performative things. It's not about how well you know the Bible. It's not about, those are all tertiary at best, you know? And then so in more recent times, as like this sort of scandal has broken out, like, you know, our ministers who we thought were like, I don't know, like closer to God or something, called by God to preach the gospel, like, wow, you must be a really godly man, and it turns out you're a predator. What, like, try to wrap your head around that.
Or protecting predators that they knew about.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other, yeah, one. Yes, wow, the enabling of it too. And it's like, what is going on in my world? And so then I'm like reflecting on like the fellowship that I'm, or faith that I'm a part of, and I'm thinking like, I got to rethink this stuff altogether. And so I'm a part of a group of people where we've kind of banded together and said, like, we love how our group meets. We enjoy that. We enjoy a sort of a small scale participatory type fellowship. Nothing against, hey, if you like going to the mega church with 2,000 people in the congregation, good on you. I like my little group here. That's just my thing. Right? I'm a small town boy. I like these little things. And so we're like, so we don't want to lose that, but We can't, or we're not comfortable having our name associated with something where there's a ministerial group that is covering up, enabling, and perpetrating abuse. And so if that means that we get kicked out, you know, so we've like thrown out the idea of them like having any authority whatsoever, which is a crazy thing to say. But it's like, I think Jesus taught his apostles to be servant leaders or servant ministers of the gospel, not overlords. And I think those in positions of ministering the gospel forget that they're supposed to be servant ministers of the message, not overlords over the people and administrators.
Yes. Huge. And I think COVID in some ways also helped bring a lot of that to the light or magnify what was already there. And I found myself in a few arguments here and there. I guess people don't like it when you point out the Pharisees and what a modern day Pharisee would look like. And it's
wow, I'm a Pharisee. Like, I was the Pharisee. Like, what the heck?
Well,
I get to be that person?
I wish that would be the response that came out of those discussions. But usually what I would hear in response is, you know, I may not be the perfect person, but I know what the Bible says. And the Bible, and they just like hone in and double down on that position. So, it's like, okay.
Here's what, like, one of my meditations recently. So Jesus talks about like he was a Pharisee. I forget his name. Maybe it was Nicodemus or whatever. Anyways, comes to him and says like, hey, like what's the greatest commandment of all?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, love your God with your heart, soul, and mind. The second great commandment is like this, basically of the same magnitude or weight. Love your neighbor as yourself. The man being willing to justify himself says, well, who's my neighbor? You know, like, surely it's some caveats around. And then he tells the story of the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
The parable. And it's like the person lying in the ditch. And it was a Samaritan that helped him. Now, why did Jesus use a Samaritan? Because Jesus was Jewish, and the Jewish people didn't have dealings with the Samaritans. They were seen as an unclean, impure people because they had intermingled with the nations around them instead of being God's chosen people. And yet the Levite and the Pharisee, the priesthood, the ministers, if you will, walk past the guy bleeding in the ditch.
The guy's expected to do something.
The reject, right, is the one that goes and helps him. And it's like, oh, so I have to rethink. So he says to him, though, all the law and prophets hang on these two things. Basically, everything else doesn't matter if you aren't doing these two things. And I was like, dang, this was me.
Yeah.
Like I was that guy that was like, man, I can quote scripture. I can follow this. And looking down on people because I don't know, they weren't following the Bible as good as me. Maybe they got piercings or tattoos or whatever, you know, and so on. And it's like, you've made the outside of the cup clean, but you forgot the inside is dirty. And I was like, oh, I just felt like so condemned. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, man, I gotta sort this business out. Like, and then thinking like, I found the way to like salvation or have an eternal salvation. And so everybody else who doesn't believe in the way that I do, well, they're going to go to hell. I was like, whoa, let's just take a step back there and sort of rethink this, fella. Because and it's opened up like fellowship like I've never had before with people of like different walks and different denominations and stuff like that. And it's like, I think we lost sight of the fact that Jesus is the way, not form.
Yes. He modeled the way. There we go. It's like, if I want to live my life in a way that is as close to Jesus as I can get, it's like, he kind of gave a lot of examples here. He talked a lot about, it's not what you show people you do. It's the heart. It's like the motivation behind what you're doing. And I was like, oh wow, that makes so much more sense. I was more, atheist / agnostic most of my life. And then my wife made a deal with God, and it turns out I made one too, when I was 27, about to go to Iraq. And it's like, oh, wow, well played, sir. You got us both to make a deal with you. But anyway.
So you made a deal with God. You're like, hey, maybe you do exist. And so if I don't die over there, I'll worship you or something like that.
It was the opposite. Like, so that's the common one. Like, if you get me out of this, I promise you, I'll worship you day and night. I was convinced as the medic who was supposed to get out instead of go to war, all the movies tell you, I'm dying. Like, he's the medic for one. Two, he's the short timer. He's not making it out of this. And so I was resigned to that on March 19th, 2003. And I got ready for war. I kind of looked around. I even wrote the letter home that not even the in case I die. It was the Olivia, I love you so much. I love our kids so much. I want our daughter to know how much I love her, even though she's not born yet. And I sent that sucker. Boom. But then I felt like, man, I feel like I've covered all my bases but one. I mean, what am I missing here? And I happen to look across and there's a chaplain doing a Catholic something with one of the soldiers. And then I noticed they had done the cross thing on themselves. I'm like, meh, what could it hurt? I mean, if there's a God, great. If not, I'm where I am. And so I said to him, God, if you're real, you will replace me with somebody who will love my wife better than I did and raise my kids as if they were his own and help them become the people they were meant to be. And that's all I got for you. So apparently that was my deal. That was a prayer. Didn't know it at the time. and off I go to war. My wife at the same time, though, is praying back in Texas. And she's like, God, if you bring him back in one piece, I promise you my whole family will go to church. I don't know what will happen after that. That's up to you. But please bring him home in one piece. And sure enough, so that was March. She's praying every single day. I forgot about my little prayer. July comes around. We're pulled out of Iraq. I'm in Kuwait now, defusing. And then they bring us back to the States, I think in early August. And I'm like, huh, I didn't die. That's kind of cool. All right, great. And then I'm reunited with my family and we're driving home at like 2 a.m. And my wife says, hey, I got something I need to share with you. Do you promise not to get mad? I say, of course I won't get mad. What is it? And I'm thinking, you know, it's one of two things because the chaplain told us either
she had an affair.
Either that or we got new furniture. And, so I ask her like, hey, did we get new furniture? And she's like, yeah, how did you know? And I'm like, just hoping. and then from there she says, but that's not what else I needed to tell you. And I thought, oh my gosh, she got a boyfriend too? What the heck? That's a double whammy. And I'm like, what is it? And she said, I know you're not very religious, but while you were gone, I was praying over you every single day. And I promised God that if he brought you home, I would bring my family to church. And so I thought I'd ask you right now, would you be okay with that? And I was like, oh gosh, there's no boyfriend. Good. Like that's in my head. But I thought, man, wow. So she committed us to church. And, but then like,
that's way better than committing adultery.
Oh yes. Way better. I'll take that any day. And, even though I wasn't religious, there was a core value that I did hold on to. And that was the family, like the Duke and Crest motto, which was by virtue and valor. And I knew I at least had to help my wife honor her promise. Even if it was to somebody I thought wasn't real, she needs to honor that promise as a Dugan. I need to support that as her husband. I was like, well, I can't make you be a liar. So yeah, we'll find a church. It's like, but you didn't like the churches we tried before you went to war. I'm like, well, I'm sure there's more than two or three. I mean, we only tried two or three. And I was like, I'll just ask Morales in the unit. I mean, he the whole time we were deployed, he was always talking about how much he missed his church, how much he loved his church. I'll just ask him. It turns out it might be a fun place, and it's not our typical type of, you know, fire and brimstone place. And it was a couple of years after that, I was in a men's Bible study, and we were talking about being a new creation in Christ and dying to your old self. Like we were tackling that concept for the first time. And, somebody in the group had asked, like, when did you realize you had died to yourself, or in what ways did you die to yourself, to become this new creation? And I was like, and it just hit me. It was like that prayer in Iraq on March 19th, 2003, that God, if you're real, you'll replace me with somebody who will love my wife better than I did and raise my children as if they were his own. And raise them in the way they should go and the people they should become, not what I want them to be. And when that hit me, I was like, oh my gosh. And I just started crying right there. No context for the guys at the table. I just started crying and sobbing, and they were trying to ask me if I'm okay. And they thought it was because I had lost my job a year prior. And I'm like, they're like, let's just go ahead and pay the tab. They paid for my breakfast. I got a free breakfast that morning. The pastor's dad was in my group, so he stayed a little bit longer to let me calm down and try to get some English out of me. And so when I told him, he's like, you totally need to share that next week. I'm like, if I become a blubbering idiot, though, you need to take over the story and tell it for me. He goes, all right, cool. That's cool. And we split up for the next week, and it came back, and I shared the story with them. They're like, wow, that's crazy. And my wife made a deal. Apparently I made one too. And 4 years later, I got to see that come to fruition. It was just like, wow. Okay. I'm in.
What an amazing story.
Thank you.
I'll just share something honestly here. Had I heard that maybe even 5 years earlier, I might've dismissed it. Cause I don't even know what denomination you're a part of. And really it's irrelevant at this point in time, but I might've dismissed it because I was hearing you describe something that's like not sort of what I'm familiar with in terms of Christianity.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like, so I'm Canadian, and I feel like American Christianity is like a little bit different than like anywhere else in the world. There's like a level of, I don't really know. And it's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just different. And so I think there's this phrase that gets used, like, have you been saved, or you've accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior and things. And like that language feels kind of unfamiliar to me because I'm like, I suppose it was just assumed like that, like at some point in time I made a decision, which I was probably 14 or so when I kind of made the decision, and then 16 when I sort of sealed that decision and then went on to live a life of not a very good one, nothing close to a Christian life for about 5 years before I realized that this life is that the life that I was living was empty. And maybe I didn't want to be like a partying, fornicating, whatever, you know, guy. And I was like, okay, I got to rethink this. And as I was trying to rethink the life that I wanted to live, it's like the woman who would become my wife came into my life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, we've had this like really, really interesting kind of like faith journey together. And thinking about how like faith evolves, it's like you go from like being a kid to being an adult, and you realize, you know, for example, like I mentioned earlier, this sort of a sexual abuse crisis happening in our fellowship. And I was like, you know, this sucks. And the voice is like, yeah, it does. And you're a man. And it's time for you to stop waiting for somebody else to stand up and say something. It is time for you to raise your voice. It's like, what? I was, you know, because I was just used to being like, I'll just sit in the background. Other people can talk. They can do their thing. And it was like, it's time for you to raise your voice. And I was like, what am I going to say? So I ended up writing one piece that basically described Jesus with a whip in his hand walking towards the ministry. And I wrote about that.
Oh, wow.
And saying, you've turned this ministry into a den of abusers. It didn't get me kicked out. But I was like, I could have never imagined that I would have written something like that. And yet I felt so powerfully moved to write it that I did.
Yeah.
And I talked about grooming as satanic evil. And because I think satanic evil is not what we think about, you know, rituals in a dark room with candles, you know, sacrificing a cat or something like that. It's posing as an angel of light.
Yeah.
Posing as a minister of the gospel and using that position to manipulate and deceive to gain access to your prey.
Yeah.
I was like, dang.
Yeah.
Like everything, my whole, like, you know, so talk about my faith is literally evolving at the time of recording this. As I'm going through all of this, being like, what? I feel like I have to strip everything down to the beginning and go, okay, where do I start? Because everything I thought I knew, like it got stripped away from me once before, and now it's getting stripped away from me again. And so there's this idea of like the fundamentals. What does it actually mean to be a follower of Jesus? And it turns out it doesn't mean all the things I used to think it did. And I think what Jesus' words when he was like, you know, you said like, Lord, Lord, have we not done all these good things in your name? He said, I don't know you.
Yeah.
I never knew you, you know? It's like, okay, so I got to rethink. I'm 41 years old going, I got to rethink my relationship with Jesus. Like, what does this mean? What does it mean? If I'm going to call myself a Christian and a follower of him, like, I got to rethink this whole darn thing. And I was kind of, but I was reassured. I was like, okay, I think I got the starting point. Jesus is God's son and he's God's anointed king and he's going to be the judge because he lived as a man. And so he understands the human condition. Okay, we start with that. And like, we eventually get to like his death and his resurrection, what that means too. But that's actually a little bit further down the line. So, I've been like trying to reconstruct all of this, and there's this really helpful series by, he's like a Baptist megachurch. I don't even know what denomination. He's a Baptist megachurch guy, and it's funny because I have this sort of discomfort with like people using that to amass wealth and claim that it's God. But on the same token, I was like, man, he said some things that really helped me, and his name is Andy Stanley.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And so I was like, I would have rejected him a lot before. Because he's not a part of whatever I believe, or I don't even know what the Baptists believe. I was like, I got no idea. I think they're like fundamental-ish type whatevers, but I'm like, I actually have no idea, which was great. So I was like, okay, let me just listen to this guy with his fancy technology and stuff and his electronic drawing board and his headset and the big stage and, you know, but let me just listen to what he's saying. I was like, oh, he's actually saying some good stuff. Oh, it's okay for me to like listen to it and like, hey, it comes from someone who's not a part of my denomination and that's okay. You know?
Yeah.
And then I got listening to this other fella, John Lennox, this Irish apologist, yes. Mathematician. And I was like, what is happening to me? I'm listening to people again, John Lennox. I don't know what he's a part of. I have no idea what his denomination is, but I was just listening to his stuff. And I was like, it's, you know, I'm a former nanotech researcher. I did mathematics and high level physics and stuff. And I'm like, it's interesting because in that world, I was actually trying to find out if God exists or not when I was studying these things in my early 20s. And I couldn't get satisfactory answers from like the physicists and the astrophysicists and stuff like that. So I was like, and so to now listen to him 20 odd years later as a mathematician describe this stuff, I'm like, wow, this is really helpful for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he talks about faith being evidence-based. It's not this blind magic wizard in the sky. Like these people try to denigrate, like, oh, you just believe in some magical sky wizard. Actually, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, so, yeah.
The scope and scale, too, when you realize, you know, God is the creator of everything. And it's like, everything? Everything. It's like,
yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like, wow, what if he's, and I think a lot of us try to contain him in our understanding of ourselves. Yeah. And so it's a limited view. Like, well, God couldn't have created everything. Look how big the universe is. It's like, what if he is that big? Well, why would he pay attention to us? What if he could? Like, you know, what if he's that powerful? He's able to hone in on us. Well, how do we know we're not, you know, we're the only ones? I'm like, what if we're not the only ones? You know, like we know what the message is to us and the Bible to us and those kinds of things, but he's God. You know, we'll probably never understand.
Well, and for those listening, like I'm sitting here nodding my head, which is again, maybe if you're listening, not seeing the video, like you might wonder like what sort of relevance is it? But I think the journey to get to the place where I nod my head to these things, where it's like when you go into like a PhD type research, you're studying more and more about less and less. And the more you study, the more you realize you don't know. I'm like, the more that I like study, I'm like, wow, I know nothing. like, I feel like I know nothing. And that, and that's okay. That's a good place to be. Now, this isn't blind faith. Mm-hmm. This is a maturation of faith and a realization that, like, hey, I got a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, that God meets me where I'm at. And he goes, all right, you're at a really good place now, because before I really couldn't reach you with some of these things because you were kind of stubborn.
Yeah.
And stuck in your ways. And I'm not going to kick down the door to your heart.
And, you know, in what ways have you seen the way you treat others shift because of this, this growth in your faith and this aha moment, you know, God is bigger.
It starts with compassion. So for a long time, I misunderstood and didn't even like compassion, which is crazy to say as a Christian, but I thought it was soft and weak and enabling unhelpful behaviors and stuff. And it turns out it's not. And it's become a central core of the work that I do professionally. It's like, hey, probably wasn't a good thing you did that thing, but let's actually just look to understand how did you get to the place where this is what you're doing. And so I think about the woman that was caught in adultery, brought before Jesus, you know, by rights under the Jewish law, she could have been stoned to death.
Yeah.
Right. But he looked at her and he said, I'm paraphrasing, but I know why you did what you did. And because I know your heart, I'm going to help you. And it goes back to the great commandment of all the law and the prophets, 600 plus commandments in Deuteronomy that none of us could ever come close to trying to follow. Good grief. It all hangs about these two things. And if you don't have those things, nothing else matters. And it's Paul talked about it in his, famous 1 Corinthians 13 and his talk about charity. It does not matter what you do if it's not built on that. And so now all of a sudden, I'm open to having conversations with maybe someone who's not a Christian and not being scared. I'm oh gosh, they might undermine my faith. Or maybe they won't. Maybe I'll just have a conversation with somebody and not treat everybody else who doesn't believe exactly the same thing I do as an enemy and somebody who's out to get me. And just being actually letting God kind of take the reins here a little bit and being it's okay. You're going to be okay. One of the more powerful talks I listened to recently was this fellow John Lennox gave a talk on why is there suffering in the universe? And obviously, I'd say just go listen to it. but one of the things he talked about is having kids is a risk. Your kid could grow up to be a murderer. Your kid could grow up to be an amazing human being. You don't know. But that doesn't stop you from having kids. God gave us free will. And as such, he took a risk. I'm going to give you free will so that it's a choice to love me. It's a choice to serve me. And the risk I'm going to take is you might not want to do that. And I might lose you. So we think about God is this angry God casting people into hell. It's no, we make that choice. Because God said, look, I give you this life. And I'm going to try and win your heart. And we know exactly how he did it, right? I think about Ephesians, whatever it is, or Galatians, whatever that one is, about wives, submit yourselves to your husbands. Husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church.
It's Ephesians 5.
You think I know it's, it was Ephesians. For some reason, got tripped up and thought maybe it was Galatians for a sec. it was Ephesians 5. So I think about, I'm a bit of a sidetrack just to bring the whole thought together. It doesn't say husbands make your wives submit. It says husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. Okay. So how did he love the church and how does he win our hearts? Through sacrifice of himself. Okay. My wife's submission has nothing to do with me. And if anything, in my submission to God, I'm essentially laying my life down for her, sacrificing myself to win her heart so that she will love me freely. So that's the love that God has for us. I want to win your heart. If we reject that and we say, I don't want you in my life, it's actually us who separates ourselves from God. God doesn't want to be separated from us, but he respects our free will. So this whole idea of God being this angry, vengeful God, God said, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. But that he would repent and come to a knowledge of me. That's what he wants. And so I'm like, oh, it turns out God's not this angry, hammer-swinging, tyrant. But he gives us free choice, and he tries to win our love. And he did it in the most amazing way.
I love that. We're over time, but hey, it was worth it.
Yes, I get fired up sometimes too.
It's okay. I mean, it was just let's do it. Let's keep going. So folks, go listen to Coach John's podcasts, Between the Before and After, and then the new one that he shared with us, The Hidden Truth. You could also go to his website, johnmclernan.com. If you don't know how to spell it, it's JonMClernon. com. And if you're like, huh, just go to the show notes. It'll be there too. Any final words of wisdom before we go, John?
Just be open. Be open. Be open to the scary idea of letting go of everything you thought was true, and then just to receive what God wants to show you. And life will fall into place in a way that you could never have expected, but it'll be the best thing for you.
Love it. That's the best way to end this episode. John, it was great to connect with you again and to have you on this show. And I look forward to staying in touch with you, man.
Thank you.
Wow. I hope you got a lot out of that conversation like I did. And if you want more, if you want to find John and you want to be mentored by him, see if he has any space in his calendar to add you as a client, then check out the show notes at beyondtherut.com/412. That's for episode 412. And there you'll find links to his show as well as his website. And, you know, that's Freedom Lifestyle Coaching, but I'll also throw in there Freedom Nutrition Coaching, and then the link to his show Between the Before and After. And then he's got that new show out there, which I mentioned at the very end, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. Now, again, I love that you're here. The best thing you could do to say thank you to me is to hit that share button and share this episode with a friend, a family member, a coworker, or that neighbor across the street. That's right. And then if you want early access to a lot of these interviews, because I interviewed John months ago, and before that, we were chatting for months before we even got together and did the recording. And so it could be a good half year before you hear a lot of the great folks I'm interviewing for this show and getting these lessons from them. And so if you want early access to that, or if you want to be able to submit questions for upcoming guest interviews, then join the Patreon community. And to get there, you just go to beyondtherut.com/Patreon, and you'll see the levels that are available. Pick the one that suits you and get that early access to this great content so that you're getting a leg up on everybody else, but more so, you're getting a leg up on where you are right now. So you don't have to wait on me to get that nice polished episode out there. You can get the raw information. You can ask questions that will help drive the interview and so on. So love to see you in the community. And with that said, you know, I'm glad you joined me on this episode, and I look forward to joining with you again on the next one. But until then, go live life beyond the rut. Take care.